Good morning, everyone. We want to go ahead and get started because we are hoping to have a very rich conversation this morning. I want to thank you all for coming this morning to our roundtable discussion. My name is Elizabeth Hyde. We all want to begin by thanking Katie Crawford and Lauren Kay and the rest of the program committee for their work in planning and hosting the 2016 French Historical Studies Conference here at Vanderbilt University. You're all in for a real treat this morning. By the end of our session, I think we'll all come away with a sense of the rich sights, smells, tastes, and textures of 17th and 18th century Paris. And not just that, the sights, smells, tastes, and textures of 17th and 18th century Paris that could be had for a price. For our papers today address cultures of consumption in early modern France, cultures that emerged around the creation, promotion, and consumption of luxury goods, medicines, and foodstuffs, consumables that were intended for the ingestion or the adornment of the body, consumables that could be simultaneously touted for their salubriousness or tut-tutted for their degenerative properties. But certainly, consumables that demonstrate the varied and growing means by which those with expendable income could indulge the self as something to be worked upon, inside and out. Before we hear from our roundtable participants, a couple of words about how our discussion will be structured. I will introduce each speaker who will offer a five-minute discussion of her work. When all of our panelists have spoken, we will not have a formal comment, but rather I will offer a few questions to start the conversation and then open up that conversation to panelists and to the room. Please note that our panel is being filmed for the Age France Online Salon series, so if you would like to ask a question or make a comment, please wait for the microphone to come to you. Okay? All right. Yes. Our first speaker is Lynn Wood Mullenauer. Lynn is Associate Professor of History at the University of North Carolina at Wilmington. She received her PhD from Northwestern University. She's the author most recently of Breaching the Wall, Beyond the Convent and Catholic Reformation in Europe, published in the Journal of Women's History. And she's the author, of course, of Strange Revelations, Magic, Poison, and Sacrilege in Louis XIV's France. She's currently working on a piece entitled From Marvel to Medicine to Merchandise, A Long Strange History of an Early Modern Wonder Drug, from which she draws her presentation today, Coral Cordials and Pearl Juleps, Fashion and Fraud in the 17th Century Medical Marketplace. Lynn?
Thank you. I should say that I have cut out the corals out of my talk. We're talking about pearls today. It's an ambitious title, I guess, when I started. And my paper today is part of a larger project that explores the construction and the transmission of medical knowledge and practice and goods in Ancien Régime France through an examination of the wonder drugs that were then in circulation, bezoars and potable gold and compounds of gemstones. And my project seeks to interrogate how and why, given a largely stable framework for the medical understanding of disease that had endured for over two millennia, how is it that certain medicines and interventions came to be accepted and then discarded? And what I want to propose today is that the wonder drugs that I'm studying, such as those made with gold and pearls, fell into disuse in the 18th century because of extra medical reasons. And what I mean by that is that challenges regarding their lack of therapeutic efficacy played less of a role than did condemnation of their cost and their association with wasteful, even foolish, luxury and extravagance. So since the classical age, precious stones were valued for their powerful therapeutic qualities, and medical authorities like Dioscorides and Galen had advocated the medicinal use of stones such as jasper and coral and amber. Of course, stones is a category more broadly conceived than now. And medical confidence in the healing powers of gems persisted across centuries. See, the knowledge and use of pearls and medicines is really global in reach, and it's found in European, it's found in Indian, it's found in Islamic medical traditions, and I think is evidence of the interaction and exchange and connection between them, connections that were facilitated by the shared medical understanding of humoral pathology, in which disease was understood to be caused by imbalance or impurity of one of the four humors. Now, gemstones retain their place in European pharmacopoeia throughout the pre-modern era. The medieval lapidary that expressed the kind of mainstream perspective on precious stones is that by Marbot of Rennes, who said that God endowed precious stones with singular powers, like the powers that herbs have, but far greater. And that belief was in place 500 years later when, for instance, one of the anonymous participants in Renaudot's mid-17th century conferences attested, All precious stones are thought to have some virtue against indisposition of the body or mind. So when I started my research into lapidary medicine, which is that system of healing based on the therapeutic use of precious stones, I turned to the foundational text in the field, which is Pliny the Elder's Natural History. And Pliny describes the origins and properties of a variety of natural wonders, like dog-headed men, like basilisks, and he relates a number of strange and wondrous tales. And it includes a remarkable account of Cleopatra's pearl. And so here is the origin of the second most famous story of the Egyptian queen. I mean, you thought there was only one, but there are two. So I think this merits being read in full. According to the disapproving Pliny, and he's very disapproving, right? The last of the Egyptian queens owned the two largest pearls of all time, left to her by Oriental kings. When Antony was stuffing himself daily with rare foods, she proudly and impertinently, like the royal harlot that she was, sneered at his attempts at luxury and extravagance. When he asked her what could be added in the way of sumptuousness, she replied that she would use up to 10 million sesterces, which is a lot of money, at one dinner. So they made a bet, and on the next day she set before Antony a dinner that was under other circumstances would have been a magnificent one, but was an everyday affair for Antony. And Antony laughed at her, but she said that she was going to consume the 10 million sesterces dinner all by herself. Then she ordered the dessert to be served, and the servants placed but one dish before her, containing vinegar, whose acidity and strength dissolves pearls into slush. So while Antony was wondering what in the world she was going to do, she took one pearl from her ear, plunged it into the vinegar, and when it was dissolved, swallowed it. And thus did Cleopatra win her bet, and thus did Pliny's royal harlot of Egypt become a metonymic for greed and hedonism. And Pliny's remarkable tale of truly conspicuous consumption continued to be told over and over again in the Ancien Régime, in France and beyond. It's found in an eclectic array of sources, from treatises on painting, Alberti's on painting, to plays, even to dictionaries. Richelieu's dictionary of 1703 makes numerous references to Cleopatra, to her pearl, to her sumptuous banquet. The definition for earring describes Cleopatra's pearl earrings of inestimable price. And that for Dessoud states, Cleopatra took a large pearl, which she threw into a glass, and when it had been dissolved, she swallowed it. And then excess is illustrated by the sentence, the expense of the feast of Antony and Cleopatra was excessive. And that tale, so it's found in lapidaries and pharmacopoeia and medical treatises, too. It's in Anselme de Bot's Le Prophet Joyeux, which is the standard work on precious stones in the 17th century. And he, too, describes, right, the largest pearl ever known is one. He says it's worth 50,000 gold a cube, but it's Cleopatra's earring, and it's swallowed in vinegar at the superb feast she presented to Antony. And he also provides a chart detailing the value of different pearls. And then the next section of his work describes the various medicines that are made from pearls and the illnesses which they treat, including quintessence of pearls, which was useful for strengthening the heart and preventing apoplexy, and also easing hemorrhoids. Wide application. And what's suggestive about the juxtaposition of the story of Cleopatra's banquet with the recipes for medicinal compounds is that both of the remedies he describes are made with dissolved pearls, pearls dissolved in vinegar. And in fact, the most commonly consumed medicine in the 17th century was a pearl magister, right? Magister de pearl, powdered pearl dissolved in vinegar, just like Cleopatra's had been. But a magister is the solid precipitate left after ground pearl has been dissolved in vinegar. And they were also even more expensive to purchase than the natural seed pearls that apothecaries sold in bulk for medicinal purposes. So certainly costly and rare medicines, especially those known to have been taken by no less august a personage than Louis XIV, they were perceived as desirable consumer goods. And in an age when affluence and power and social place were bound together, to consume medicines made of precious stones was to make a claim for one's elevated status and discriminating taste and wealth. One early 17th century apothecary wrote that pearls were like bezoars and ambergris and unicorn horn. They were medicines that were, quote, too exquisite for those of the common herd. Now, that view did not go unchallenged. The medical efficacy of pearls was criticized by medical practitioners from the 16th century forward, like Laurent Joubert, like Ambroise Paré, like Guy Patin, who hates everything, by the way, so I'm not sure that's a good example. It's like, hates everything but bleeding. Blood bleeds. But Guy Patin writes, I boldly assert that all these drugs and compositions have no true or legitimate use in medicine. They're full of luxury and superstition. They serve only to deceive the people. And the high cost of pearls was similarly deplored. Philibert Guibert, it's an author of a number of charitable medical works, he wrote these works so that that people could make their compound their own remedies at home and avoid being cheated by apothecaries. And he says, you know, I've provided all these recipes and I've not added any pearls or fragments of gemstones or gold leaf because those do nothing but elevate the price. And they make the remedies too dear without providing any relief. So I think what we see is that objections of physicians and surgeons to using gemstones, those objections that are made on therapeutic grounds, I would argue are amplified by the association of pearl-based medicines with the extravagant and greedy and luxurious Queen of Egypt. I mean, certainly many educated people wrote or read medical treatises, but many more were exposed to the plays and paintings and novels and political tracts and natural histories and dictionaries, right, that all depict Cleopatra's hedonism. And as references to Cleopatra's pearl continued apace, right, lapidary medicine was increasingly derided as fit only for dupes. And medicines like that were depicted as the province of the unsophisticated fools who consumed them and the knaves who peddled them. Molière right, famously has a scene in The Doctor in Spite of Himself, where the pretend physician prescribes his foolish patient a cheese made with tincture of gold and coral and pearls and other precious materials. So by the middle of the 18th century, right, lapidary medicine in general and the medicinal consumption of pearls was in decline. And even the apothecaries who composed the costly remedies had distanced themselves from their use. Pierre Pomé, for instance, wrote that right, a magisterian salt right, composed with pearls they, to which are attributed large virtues. Besides other imaginary preparations, and he lists a few, of like essences and tinctures and the like, that exist to pick fools' pockets. So if Lawrence Brockles and Collins-Jones are correct to argue that patient demand drove medical practice during the Ancien Régime, I would argue that the association with lapidary medicine with the hedonistic and the wasteful and the foolish was instrumental in its decline. Thank you.